Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on The Voice of America. I'm Nabil Biagio on this live broadcast from Studio 14. Here are some of the top stories making news across South Sudan and Sudan this Monday, December 11, 2023. A humanitarian convoy came under attack in Khartoum on Sunday, which resulted in two deaths and several injuries.
They were hit by the fire, and as a result, unfortunately, two people, a driver and assistant, tragically died, and seven people were injured.
And on Human Rights Day, the U.S. ambassador to South Sudan urges an end to sexual and gender-based violence across the country.
Worldwide, nearly one-third of women experience physical or sexual violence during their lifetime. We understand that figure stands at more than 65% in South Sudan. That is two out of every three women. That statistic is abhorrent and must be unacceptable to all South Sudanese people.
We will have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. An assault yesterday on an international committee of the Red Cross humanitarian convoy in Khartoum claimed two lives and left seven others injured. Local and wire reports cited sources within the Sudan Armed Forces who blamed the ICRC for violating terms of an evacuation operation that led to the attack. Aliona Sinenko, ICRC spokesperson for Africa, condemns the incident and calls for protection of humanitarian workers from Sudan's warring factions.
Our convoy that consisted of three buses and three ICRC vehicles were heading from Wad Madani area to Khartoum to evacuate vulnerable civilians, including children, elderly people who were stuck in an area with heavy fighting without food and access to health care. But unfortunately, they were not able to reach the area because they were hit by the fire. And as a result, unfortunately, two people, a driver and assistant, tragically died, and seven people were injured, including three ICRC staff. And out of the seven people who were injured, two were very seriously injured. And they are now in hospital. And we are, of course, extremely worried and outraged by this incident because the humanitarian workers should never pay the price with their own life to be able to do their work.
Yes, you say incident, but this was a deliberate attack. Is that correct?
Yes, the convoy was attacked, was shot at, and indeed, this is a very serious incident for us, and that because one of the main activities, one of the pillars of our humanitarian work, according to the mandate that we have, is to be able to cross the front lines, and we do this to bring life-saving aid to people, to evacuate people who stuck in conflict areas, including some of the most vulnerable. And if the humanitarian mission and the emblem, the protective Red Cross, Red Crescent emblem, is not respected, then this just puts into question our ability to do this life-saving work.
So the vehicles were clearly marked as ICRC property carrying out humanitarian operations, and I assume you coordinated the evacuation operation with both the army and the rapid support forces, the warring factions in Sudan. Did you do that?
Indeed. This is the standard procedure. Our teams, all our vehicles, they're always very clearly marked with the Red Cross emblem. And this was the case yesterday. And also before making any movement in a conflict area affected by the fighting, we always coordinate with the parties to the conflict. And this was what was done yesterday as well.
Do you know which party attacked your convoy, and have you received any communications, or have you corresponded with either side or both of them over this?
We are in touch with both sides. There were also some communications that the parties were issuing about this incident, about what happened. For us, it is not, we don't want to play the blame game. We are, of course, extremely heartbroken and shocked about what happened to our personnel and also people who were working with us, the bus driver, and just unimaginable to think what their families are going through right now. We are talking to the parties. It is an extremely severe incident. For us, the priority is to ensure that this does not happen in the future, that the international humanitarian law is respected, and this law protects civilians, but also humanitarian personnel and medical workers. And it's crucial that all the necessary measures are taken on the ground by the warring parties to spare civilians from harm.
The army seems to accept responsibility for this, and they blame the ICRC. Army sources are quoted as saying the ICRC convoy violated some of the terms of the evacuation arrangement. They came too close to their defensive, the army defensive positions, while utilizing a vehicle or vehicles belonging to the rebels. That's the Rapid Support Forces. What can you tell me about this claim?
Well, I can tell you what, I can just reiterate what I have already told you about what happened yesterday, is that we were in communication and following the routes, and that our teams, they were in vehicles that were marked by the Red Cross emblem.
That's Aliona Sinenko, ICRC spokesperson for Africa. She spoke with me from Nairobi, Kenya, this past hour. IGAD Executive Secretary Werknei Gebreyehu announced on Saturday that Sudan's Sovereign Council Chairman Abdel Fattah al-Burhan and Rapid Support Forces leader Mohamed Hamdan Dagalo have agreed to sign a cessation of hostilities agreement during the 41st extraordinary session of the IGAD Assembly in Djibouti. The Assembly also proposed a face-to-face meeting between General Burhan, who is also the Army Chief, and General Dagalo, as well as the appointment of an envoy to Sudan. I spoke with Salman Mohamed Salman, a Sudanese political analyst and chairman of the University of Khartoum Council. He says the shift from the Jeddah negotiations to end Sudan's eight-month-long conflict to the region is important.
I think it's a very, very significant shift. The Jeddah has been basically confined to Saudi Arabia and the United States. Yes, IGAD was there, but as a minor representative and the EU. And I think it's a shift because, first, the Jeddah Forum hasn't really made any progress. So many agreements and all of them dishonored, and very short terms agreement, very short term agreements, and very limited in scope. It's ceasefire and humanitarian assistance should be allowed. Here we have a very wide range of participants, 15 participants, including heads of states and prime ministers, and representatives of the special envoy of the U.S. to the IGAD, which indicates that the U.S. has no problem with this with this shift from Jeddah to Djibouti, and then the representation of other even Saudi Arabia is also there, which indicates that Saudi Arabia and the U.S. really didn't see it and haven't seen it as a competition or as takeover. It's just another forum, and let's work through them. So I think it is there is no problem for the Jeddah leaders of the process, Saudi Arabia and the U.S., and the U.S., because they are participating in the IGAD. And it's a wider range in IGAD, as I mentioned, 14 participants. And the issues are also wider. So it's a major shift in terms of region, in terms of substance and issues and decisions.
Yes, and the meeting
decided on some concrete steps to be taken, appointing an envoy to Sudan. They even said the two sides have agreed to sign a ceasefire, although they haven't signed a ceasefire yet. And they propose a face-to-face meeting between the two top generals in this war in Sudan, this conflict in Sudan, General Burhan, General Hemeti. How do you see these steps that have been proposed, and do you see real commitment here?
Yeah, let me, before I go to the commitment, let me just comment on the Burhan attended the meeting. He has been running around, but he has attended the meeting, and that raised hopes that he will now, once that he will be, he will abide by what he has participated in. I think what troubled the Burhan and what troubled Sudanese army and Islamist is the sudden appearance through video, or I don't know if it's video or audio, of the conversation with Hemeti. An appearance of Hemeti as a statesman saying that, oh yes, I'm going, first he's an equal to them. So he's there and they're listening to him and listening to them. That troubled them. That troubled them because they want to portray Hemeti as just a rebel who shouldn't be, nobody should be talking to. So he's there, he's talking for a long time, and people are listening to him, and then he's making commitments. And I think that was that. I may be wrong, but I think the conversation with Hemeti came as a surprise to Burhan and his delegation. And so in my view, that's the reason for, and that we can talk about this later, for their statement yesterday, late yesterday, saying that
The Ministry of Foreign Affairs.
Pardon me?
The statement by the Minister of Foreign Affairs. Yes, please go ahead.
Correct. Which basically contradicted everything that was done in IGAD. Now, there was no agreement on this. There was no agreement on that. The participants were not there. It's a very unserious statement. It just shows the cannot get this regime, Burhan. Nobody can really pin him down to an agreement. But, I mean, there will be pressures on him. There will be pressures on him.
That's Salman Muhammad Salman, a Sudanese political analyst and chairman of the University of Khartoum Council. He spoke with me from the U.S. state of Virginia this past hour. On World Human Rights Day, the U.S. ambassador in South Sudan is calling on the government to prioritize ending gender-based violence and to ensure accountability for perpetrators. Ambassador Michael Adler says protecting human rights in South Sudan must come from within the country. Charlton Doki reports for VOA from Juba.
Speaking at an event in Juba, Ambassador Adler says just as in every country around the world, respect for human rights, including women's rights, must be a cornerstone on which peace is based in South Sudan.
Worldwide, nearly one-third of women experience physical or sexual violence during their lifetime. We understand that figure stands at more than 65% in South Sudan. That is 2 out of every 3 women. That statistic is abhorrent and must be unacceptable to all South Sudanese people, women, men, girls, boys, it must be unacceptable to everybody.
Adler says ongoing intercommunal violence, a worsening humanitarian crisis, and food shortages in South Sudan further perpetuate sexual and gender-based violence, or SGBV.
I repeat, we are deeply troubled by the lack of accountability for SGBV. All of us must continue to call attention to these abuses, including the unacceptable practices of use of sexual violence in conflict, domestic violence, and early and forced marriage.
Adler says addressing gender-based violence, including conflict-related violence, is vital to accountability and supporting sustainable peace.
This must be underscored by a national plan of action and a collective commitment against gender-based violence. It must also include systems and structures for accountability, and a means of restoring a sense of safety and well-being for survivors.
In 2014, South Sudan President Salva Kiir signed a joint communique with the UN, agreeing to champion the fight against conflict-related sexual violence in the country. A year later, the Sudan People's Liberation Movement in opposition unveiled its own action plan to tackle sexual violence in the country. In 2019, the South Sudan People's Defense Force announced its own action plan to address sexual violence, and a year later, South Sudan started a gender-based violence court in the capital, Juba. Brigadier Carlo James Duck is director of the Special Protection Unit, which is a body tasked with addressing sexual and gender-based violence in the South Sudan National Police Service.
Our units are within the 10 state and 3 administrative area. Within Central Equatoria, we have 9 SPU function facilities in all the divisions. And this, they investigate cases of gender-based violence, conflict related to gender-based violence, so that a survivor will have a confidence to reveal what happened to her if she's being interviewed by a female officer. And we have trained female officers. We have sent them to Rwanda, Uganda, Kenya to have more training.
Duck says the officers have been sent to Uganda, Rwanda and Kenya for more training. But Ambassador Adler says a commitment to end gender-based violence must come from within South Sudan.
This means that the transitional government must provide resources to survivors of all forms of SGBV and recognize that it is a formidable barrier to women's full participation in society. Men and boys must recognize that gender-based violence affects all of us, and they must champion the rights of their sisters, mothers, aunts, friends, grandmothers, daughters.
A little over a year ago, a United Nations panel of experts said during a conference in London that if the government of South Sudan is serious about tackling sexual violence, it should immediately remove from office and investigate governors and county commissioners accused of being complicit in systematic rape. Not a single official has been sacked since then. For VOA News, I'm Charlton Doki in Juba.
You're listening to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. Coming up, we look at the nutritional program for children implemented by the Minister of Health in South Sudan. Stay tuned.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
what skill would you most like to master?
I would love to learn how to use my hands, that is craft work, making the baskets and doing more of the clay artwork.
So I think I will go technology any day, anytime. So mastering what I do already, which is practically technology, which is software development, applications development, analysis and data mining.
I would love to play the organ. I love it. I love the sound. I would want to have it at home to play to my family.
Now many people don't like to be teachers. So for me, I'm willing to be.
I appreciate people that I can sing because I can't sing myself and I don't have a very good voice. So I will go for singing.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You're listening to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. Health officials in South Sudan say they are working to prevent malnutrition and strengthen local food systems for children across the country. The Health Ministry recently held a two-day National Food Expo in Juba. For VOA News, Juliana Shepai files this report from Juba.
Officials from South Sudan's Health Ministry, the United Nations Children Agency, UNICEF, the World Food Programme and the Food and Agriculture Organization say they are working to ensure children have access to nutritious food. The officials made the remarks at a recent food expo in the capital, Juba. The expo was organized to study how to improve access to food for young children, strengthen community structures, and share experiences for processing local foods. Rita John Dimitri is a senior nutrition inspector at South Sudan's National Health Ministry.
When you come to nutrition actually in this country, we are doing well in treatment of malnutrition, but not in prevention. So to prevent malnutrition, we have to work hard in the quality of the diet of the children that they are taking. Therefore, that's why we are here. And we are doing this food expo.
Before the expo, the nutrition cluster, which brings together officials from the health ministry and aid agencies, reached out to stakeholders in various sectors to build interest in showcasing their work on improving food systems for young children. Alex Kiwesi is a program director at Hold the Child, a national organization that is focusing on how to make healthy food for children rather than treating malnutrition.
We identified fish as a superfood, which is available almost everywhere. And so we decided to experiment around different versions of fish that appeal to different communities. And what has cut out is powder appeals to all of everybody. It's easy to transport and store and all the other things. So we started producing fish powder. And when we began to do that, we began to relate with different recipes. And so with the communities, we've improved the recipes with an addition of fish powder.
Natemo William Lewis is a nutrition manager at the Catholic Medical Mission Board, or CMMB, operating in Western Equatoria and Central Equatoria states. CMMB sees goat herds as a tool for boosting nutrition.
The goat's distribution, of course, and it will enhance the diet for our children in terms of like looking at the value, the animal proteins. And with animal proteins, that has been something lacking for us. You know, that has been something lacking. And with the goats will really help increase their protein levels for children, because malnutrition, if you don't break the cycle in the first 1,000 days, which is from conception to 2 years, if you don't break it, it becomes chronic.
Kennedy Chandiga is the head of programs at National Nonprofit Group Action for Development, or AFOD, which provides essential services for vulnerable people in Eastern Equatoria, Central Equatoria, and Western Bahr al-Ghazal states. He says the organization has been working to ensure South Sudanese are food secure since 2011.
AFOD is engaging the community to ensure that the community have access to seeds for the pumpkin and access to the feed, sensitizing them on the importance of the pumpkin, because pumpkin is in nutrient dense. Now we thought it wise as an organization to complement this with the animal protein of giving chicken to all beneficiaries, to ensure that the eggs, which has a lot of proteins for the child development, is added to their diet, to ensure that they have nutritious food. And that is the only way malnutrition can be reduced in South Sudan.
The Integrated Food Security Phase Classification Report, released in September, projects that 1.65 million children aged 5 and below in South Sudan are expected to suffer from malnutrition between July 2023 and June 2024. The IPC is a global partnership that assesses food security around the world to help government and aid organizations address needs. The report says 72% of malnourished South Sudanese children are expected to be in Jonglei, Northern Bahr al-Ghazal, Upper Nile, Unity, and Warab states. For VOA News, I am Juliana Sherpai, reporting from Juba.
Amid growing criticism over its continued support to Israel's military operation in Gaza, the United States defended its stance Sunday, but also reiterated the importance of protecting Palestinian civilians. Veronica Balders Iglesias reports.
More forcefully, with intensity. That's how Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu described Sunday the advances of his troops in Gaza.
In order to achieve all our goals, the elimination of Hamas, the return of all our abductees, and the promise that Gaza will never again be a threat to Israel.
Netanyahu also thanked the United States for vetoing a UN Security Council resolution last week that would have called for an immediate ceasefire. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken explained the decision when interviewed Sunday on ABC's This Week show.
With Hamas still alive, still intact, and again, with the stated intent of repeating October 7th again and again and again, that would simply perpetuate the problem.
As Blinken stressed the importance of providing Israel the support and weapons it needs to defend itself, he made it clear it is not without conditions.
Those rules apply to Israel as they do to any other country, including the way they're used and the need, the imperative, of respecting international humanitarian law.
But as the civilian death toll continues to rise in Gaza, the United States' stance has been strongly criticized at the Doha Forum, which is held every year to discuss world challenges. Palestinian Prime Minister Mohammed Shtaya.
It's not up to Israel only. It is those who have given
the Israelis the greenest of the green light to continue killing the Palestinians.
Ayman Safadi is Jordan's foreign minister.
In the United States, we had a very blunt conversation with Secretary Blinken. All of us, the Arab and Muslim delegation, were very clear. Our priorities are set. Stop the aggression, allow sufficient humanitarian supplies into all parts of Gaza, ensure protection of civilians.
UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres, also a forum participant, said he'll continue appealing for a humanitarian ceasefire to be declared. And from Geneva, the chief of the World Health Organization, Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus, warned about the impact the war is having on the health environment in the Gaza Strip.
As more and more people move to a smaller and smaller area, overcrowding combined with the lack of adequate food, water, shelter and sanitation are creating the ideal conditions for disease to spread.
He noted his organization has deployed teams to support health workers on the ground who are physically and mentally exhausted. Veronica Valderas Iglesias, VOA News, Washington.
And that's all we have for you this Monday. Don't forget to check out voaafrica.com for all your favorite programs and news updates. I'm your host, Nabil Biagio in Washington. On behalf of our producer, Gwen Uten, and engineer, Andres Rigas, thanks for taking the time to be with us. Remember to join us again tomorrow for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.
An editorial reflecting American ideals and institutions.
December 10th is World Human Rights Day, a date chosen to honor the adoption by the United Nations General Assembly of one of the most influential documents in modern history, the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. Today, this document turned 75 years old. Precipitating from the events of the Second World War, it was the first global enunciation of the inalienable rights of humankind. Horrified by the horrendous crimes committed against civilian populations, the United Nations General Assembly without delay began to work on codifying a set of universal human rights. The final document is based on the premise that all human beings are born free and equal in dignity and rights, as explicitly stated in the first article. The declaration, which came into force in 1950, inspired the development of international human rights law, as well as the International Bill of Human Rights. Today, the Universal Declaration of Human Rights is the world's most translated document. Since 1950, then, December 10th has annually been celebrated as Human Rights Day. To commemorate this important achievement of the United Nations, at the time barely 3 years old. On this day, the Nobel Peace Prize is formally handed over to that year's winner. And every year, the observance is dedicated to a different aspect of human rights. This year's theme is consolidating and sustaining human rights culture into the future. On Human Rights Day and during Human Rights Week, we remember and reaffirm the sacred idea that every person is created equal, endowed with inherent dignity and inalienable rights, said President Biden in a written statement. This idea was at the core of America's founding. And today, this idea beats in the hearts of millions who march, fight, and sacrifice for the innate liberties we deserve as humans. Around the world, from China to Burma, Afghanistan to Iran, Ethiopia to Ukraine, and beyond, courageous people are standing up to abuses of power, staying strong amid threats to their lives, and speaking out against violations of their fundamental freedoms, said President Biden. The United States stands fully with these brave women and men fighting for their basic human rights in the face of oppression and injustice, and we always will.
That was an editorial reflecting American ideals and institutions.